This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm going to read Marshland Elegy, part of the wonderful book, A Sand County Almanac, published in 1949 by Aldo Leopold. When Leopold died in 1948, he did not know that his book would be published. After I read Marshland Elegy, I'm going to read a letter that was written by three hunters against the proposed crane hunt. Marshland Elegy. A dawn wind stirs on the great marsh. With almost imperceptible slowness, it rolls a bank of fog across the wide morass. Like the white ghost of a glacier, the mists advance, riding over phalanxes of tamarack, sliding across bog meadows heavy with dew. A single silence hangs from horizon to horizon. Out of some far recess of the sky, a tinkling of little bells falls soft upon the listening land, then again silence. Now comes a baying of some sweet-throated hound, soon the clamor of a responding pack, then a far, clear blast of hunting horns out of the sky into the fog. The high horns, low horns, silence, and finally a pandemonium of trumpets, rattles, croaks, and cries that almost shakes the bog with its nearness, but without yet disclosing whence it comes. At last a glint of sun reveals the approach of a great echelon of birds. On motionless wing they emerge from the lifting mists, sweep a final arc of sky, and settle in clangorous, descending spirals to their feeding grounds. A new day has begun on the Crane Marsh. A sense of time lies thick and heavy on such a place. Yearly, since the Ice Age, it has awakened each spring to the clangor of cranes. The peat layers that comprise the bog are laid down in the basin of an ancient lake. The cranes stand, as it were, upon the sodden pages of their own history. These peats are the compressed remains of the mosses that clog the pools, of the tamaracks that spread over the moss, of the cranes that bugled over the tamaracks since the retreat of the ice sheet. An endless caravan of generations has built of its own bones this bridge into the future, this habitat where the oncoming host again may live and breed and die. To what end? Out on the bog, a crane, gulping some luckless frog, springs his ungainly bulk into the air and flails the morning sun with mighty wings. The tamaracks re-echo with his bugled certitude. He seems to know. Our ability to perceive quality in nature begins, as in art, with the pretty. It expands through successive stages of the beautiful to values as yet uncaptured by language. The quality of cranes lies, I think, in this higher gamut, as yet beyond the reach of words. This much, though, can be said. Our appreciation of the crane grows with the slow unraveling of earthly history. His tribe, we now know, stems out of the remote Eocene. The other members of the fauna in which he originated are long since entombed within the hills. When we hear his call, we hear no mere bird. We hear the trumpet in the orchestra of evolution. He is the symbol of our untamable past, of that incredible sweep of millennia which underlies and conditions the daily affairs of birds and men. And so they live and have their being, these cranes, not in the constricted present, but in the wider reaches of evolutionary time. Their annual return is the ticking of the geologic clock. Upon the place of their return, they confer a peculiar distinction. Amid the endless mediocrity of the commonplace, a crane marsh holds a paleontological patent of nobility, one in the march of eons and revocable only by shotgun. The sadness, discernible in some marshes, arises perhaps From their once having harbored cranes, now they stand humbled, adrift in history. Some sense of this quality in cranes seems to have been felt by sportsmen and ornithologists of all ages. Upon such quarry as this, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick loosed his gerfalcons. Upon such quarry as this, once swooped the hawks of Kublai Khan. Marco Polo tells us he derives the highest amusement from sporting with gerfalcons and hawks. At Changanore, the Khan has a great palace, surrounded by a fine plain, where are found cranes in great numbers. He causes millet and other grains to be sown in order that the birds may not want. Unquote. The ornithologist Bengt Berg, seeing cranes as a boy upon the Swedish heaths, forthwith made them his life's work. He followed them to Africa and discovered their winter retreat on the White Nile. He says of his first encounter, it was a spectacle which eclipsed the flight of the roque in the Thousand and One Nights. When the glacier came down out of the north, crunching hills and gouging valleys, some adventuring rampart of the ice climbed the Baraboo Hills and fell back into the outlet gorge of the Wisconsin River. The swollen waters backed up and formed a lake half as long as the state, bordered on the east by cliffs of ice and fed by the torrents that fell from melting mountains. The shorelines of this old lake are still visible. Its bottom is the bottom of the great marsh. The lake rose through the centuries, finally spilling over east of the Baraboo Range. There it cut a new channel for the river and thus drained itself. To the residual lagoons came the cranes, bugling the defeat of the retreating winter, summoning the on-creeping host of living things to their collective task of marsh building. Floating bogs of sphagnum moss clogged the lowered waters, filled them. Sedge and leatherleaf, tamarack and spruce successively advanced over the bog, anchoring it by their root fabric, sucking out its water, making peat. The lagoons disappeared, but not the cranes. To the moss meadows that replaced the ancient waterways, they returned each spring to dance and bugle and rear their gangling sorrel-colored young. These, albeit birds, are not properly called chicks, but colts. I cannot explain why. On some dewy June morning, watch them gambol over their ancestral pastures at the heels of the roan mare, and you will see for yourself. One year, not long ago, a French trapper in buckskin pushed his canoe up one of the moss-clogged creeks that thread the great marsh. At this attempt to invade their miry stronghold, the cranes gave vent to loud and ribald laughter. A century or two later, Englishmen came in covered wagons. They chopped clearings in the timbered moraines that border the marsh, and in them planted corn and buckwheat. They did not intend, like the great Khan at Changanore, to feed the cranes, but the cranes do not question the intent of glaciers, emperors, or pioneers. They ate the grain, and when some irate farmer failed to concede their usufruct in his corn, they trumpeted a warning and sailed across the marsh to another farm. There was no alfalfa in those days, and the hill farms made poor hayland, especially in dry years. One dry year, someone set a fire in the tamaracks. The burn grew up quickly to blue joint grass, which, when cleared of dead trees, made a dependable hay meadow. After that, each August, men appeared to cut hay. In winter, after the cranes had gone south, they drove wagons over the frozen bogs and hauled the hay to their farms in the hills. Yearly, they plied the marsh with fire and axe, and in two short decades, hay meadows dotted the whole expanse. Each August, when the haymakers came to pitch their camps, singing and drinking and lashing their teams with whip and tongue, the cranes whinnied to their colts and retreated to the far fastnesses. Red shitepokes, the haymakers called them, from the rusty hue which at that season often stains the battleship gray of crane plumage. After the hay was stacked, and the marsh again their own, the cranes returned to call down out of October skies the migrant flocks from Canada. Together they wheeled over the new-cut stubbles and raided the corn until frost gave the signal for the winter exodus. These hay meadow days were the Arcadian age for marsh dwellers. Man and beast, plant and soil, lived on, and with each other in mutual toleration, to the mutual benefit of all. The marsh might have kept on producing hay and prairie chickens, deer and muskrat, crane music and cranberries forever. The new overlords did not understand this. They did not include soil, plants, or birds in their ideas of mutuality. The dividends of such a balanced economy were too modest. They envisaged farms not only around but in the marsh. An epidemic of ditch digging and land booming set in. The marsh was gridironed with drainage canals, speckled with new fields and farmsteads. But crops were poor and beset by frost, to which the expensive ditches added an aftermath of debt. Farmers moved out. Peat beds dried, shrank, caught fire. Sun energy out of the Pleistocene shrouded the countryside in acrid smoke. No man raised his voice against the waste, only his nose against the smell. After a dry summer, not even the winter snows could extinguish the smoldering marsh. Great pockmarks were burned into field and meadow, the scars reaching down to the sands of the old lake. Peat covered these 100 centuries. Rank weeds sprang out of the ashes to be followed after a year or two by aspen scrub. The cranes were hard put, their numbers shrinking with the remnants of unburned meadow. For them, the song of the power shovel came near being an elegy. The high priests of progress knew nothing of cranes and cared less. What is a species more or less among engineers? What good is an undrained marsh, anyhow? For a decade or two, crops grew poorer, fires deeper, wood fields larger, and cranes scarcer year by year. Only reflooding, it appeared, could keep the peat from burning. Meanwhile, cranberry growers had, by plugging drainage ditches, reflooded a few spots and obtained good yields. Distant politicians bugled about marginal land, overproduction, unemployment relief, conservation. Economists and planners came to look at the marsh. Surveyors, technicians, CCCs buzzed about. A counter-epidemic of reflooding set in. Government bought land, resettled farmers, plugged ditches wholesale. Slowly, the bogs are re-wetting. The fire pox became ponds. Grass fires still burn, but they can no longer burn the wetted soil. All this, once the CCC camps were gone, was good for cranes, but not so the thickets of scrub popple that spread inexorably over the old burns, and still less the maze of new roads that inevitably follow governmental conservation. To build a road is so much simpler than to think of what the country really needs. A roadless marsh is seemingly as worthless to the alphabetical conservationist as an undrained one was to the empire builders. Solitude, the one natural resource still undowered of alphabets, is so far recognized as valuable only by ornithologists and cranes. Thus always does history, whether of marsh or marketplace, end in paradox. The ultimate value in these marshes is wildness, and the crane is wildness incarnate. But all conservation of wildness is self-defeating, for to cherish we must see and fondle. And when enough have been seen and fondled, there is no wilderness left to cherish. Someday, perhaps, in the very process of our benefactions, perhaps in the fullness of geologic time, the last crane will trumpet his farewell and spiral skyward from the great marsh. High out of the clouds will fall the sound of hunting horns, the baying of the phantom pack, the tinkle of little bells, and then a silence never to be broken, unless perchance in some far pasture of the Milky Way. And that's Marshland Elegy, Aldo Leopold. And so there has been, for many years now, the idea of starting a crane hunt in order to lessen crane damage to corn. I will now read you a letter to the editor, a letter written by three hunters titled, "Don't Stuff Sandhill Crane Hunt Down the Throat of Wisconsin. It Will Only Divide Us." This was written by Tim Isley, Dave Clausen, and Mark Martin. Tim Isley is a hunter and freelance outdoor photographer and writer. He has twice been the Conservation Communicator of the Year from the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, and he's a member of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. Dave Clausen is a lifelong hunter, retired veterinarian, and former chair of the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board. Mark Martin is a hunter, member of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, and wetland owner with nesting sandhill cranes. He was inducted into the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame in 2023. The letter is dated January 12, 2025. When the new legislature meets, it should take recommendations of the Legislative Council's Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes with a grain of salt. The committee was established with the strong influence of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, which is trying to stuff a proposal to hunt sandhill cranes down the throats of Wisconsinites. The study committee included the association's vice president, plus representatives of the Corn and Potato Growers Associations. It would have been a miracle if they did not favor a hunting season on sandhill cranes. The committee took selected testimony from Wisconsin Waterfowl Association Executive Director Bruce Ross and put it in the form of a summary of findings, which not everyone on the committee supported. In addition, the committee failed to heed the comments of past DNR waterfowl ecologist Kent Van Horn, who in August said that a hunting season in the fall is no guarantee it would help crop depredations in the spring. Van Horn also made it clear the decision to open a hunting season on cranes is a social decision. The committee heard from invited speakers only and did not invite hunters against the season to express their views. The committee based their recommendation on the constitutional amendment that guarantees the right to hunt, fish, and trap in Wisconsin. That amendment does not guarantee open seasons on all species in the state. The committee overlooked that the DNR has not recommended opening a sandhill crane hunting season in Wisconsin. The committee passed a recommendation for the legislature directing the DNR, quote, to authorize sandhill crane hunting in Wisconsin, unquote. This bypasses the normal decision-making by the Natural Resources Board to open a season. Setting seasons by the legislature is bad precedent, which later can't easily be changed, and it intentionally bypasses the established system of opening hunting and fishing seasons by the Natural Resources Board. The NRB is where biological and sociological justifications come together and where any decision should be made. If they had any legitimate intent to do what was right for Wisconsin, they would have recognized that the current crop damage law is flawed. It pays crop damage fees for species that are hunted, theoretically justifying a hunt if farmers are to get reimbursed. Wildlife belongs to everyone, and that law needs to be amended so that damages are funded with general purpose revenue funds so everyone can pay for damage to crops. The question whether a sandhill crane season should be opened is part biological, but the real question is sociological. Why? Why isn't a sandhill crane season appropriate for Wisconsin? The answer is evident to many who read Aldo Leopold's The Sand County Almanac, the trumpet in the orchestra of evolution. As Leopold described, the call of sandhill cranes are special to Wisconsinites. Many surveys show that most citizens do not support a season. A season will only further divide hunters and non-hunters when the opposite is needed. Hunting seasons differ from state to state. Look no further than Nebraska, which has thousands of sandhill cranes and does not hunt cranes. Not every state hunts every species, and Wisconsin does not need, and surveys show that a majority of citizens do not want, a hunting season on sandhill cranes. Let's bring hunters and non-hunters together so that both carry their fair share of funding for natural resources management, not further divide them. And that's Tim Isley, David Clausen, and Mark Martin. I want to add a little more information that was since January. During the migration north on their path through Indiana, 1,500 sandhill cranes, many of them headed here to Wisconsin, were found dead from the highly pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI. The deaths were reported across several counties in Indiana, including Greene County, Union County, Jasper County, LaPorte County, and Stark County. There's a vulnerability to that disease going on right now among all birds. The International Crane Foundation has, under Learn and then News and Resources, this: "We need your help. For the third time in 14 years, the Wisconsin legislature is attempting to mandate the state's Department of Natural Resources to create a sandhill crane hunting season. The International Crane Foundation is disappointed by the legislature's continued attempts to tie crop damage relief for farmers to a sandhill crane hunt, a widely unpopular proposal for the people of the state. Though there is no evidence that a hunt will provide relief to farmers experiencing crop damage by cranes, and there are other more effective ways we can support farmers experiencing these issues, we encourage you to contact your state legislators in the Assembly and the Senate." And they have a sample letter. The website for the International Crane Foundation is savingcranes.org under the heading Learn and then News and Resources. And as David Creer writes in an essay on this topic, between the avian flu, a depleting food web, increased urbanization and agriculturalization, climate changes, and a very slow reproductive cycle, they have a lot of adversity to overcome already. We certainly have the financial ability as a state to help compensate farmers for their crop damage if we were to choose that. Unquote. The bill has been introduced to the legislature. The legislation is SB Senate Bill 112 in the Senate and Assembly Bill 117. And if you want to write to your senator and assembly people, those would be the bills to address, Senate Bill 112 and Assembly Bill 117. It would be nice to see more unity among hunters and non-hunters. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.